right.
Ian Trottier here for Discussions of Truth. And what a year, right? It's been a couple of very interesting years. And for me, since I began doing the work that I do, it's been an interesting 5 years. Getting ready here today, special Sunday edition, and you can keep track of these special shows, editions, episodes that I'm doing by following me on Instagram, should you choose. And that's IANTROTTIER, Ian Trottier on Instagram. Typically, even though there's a Twitter feed for it, Real Ian Trottier, that's because the initial Twitter account that I had was taken down, censorship, right? So all I do is expose publicly available information, folks. That's all I do is expose publicly available information. I'm not bringing anything classified. I'm not bringing anything top secret. I'm simply bringing information that is widely available but not distributed to the masses. Why? Because media in the United States is tainted. Basically, the design is to divide, feed the right what it wants to hear, Fox News, feed the left what it wants to hear, MSNBC. And unfortunately, Ted Turner, that owns CNN, has seemingly sided with the left. I mean, I used to watch headline news all the time. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I don't remember CNN being left, if you will. And look, there are qualities in both right and left in the platforms here, folks. But as you dig deeper, you will find that the deep state, as it is, that is the financial reins that control the United States government and therefore its military and certainly the Department of Education, and yes, the White House, the deep state pockets, those deep pockets that control the affairs of the United States on an international level, well, their objective is to divide this country, folks, and they will do so by any means necessary to weaken the union. And you see that in regards to these Black Lives Matter movements, these Antifa movements, any type of, even the Black Panthers in the 60s, any type of social disruption or any angle to weaken the social fabric of America, whether it's pit people against each other based on race or pit people against each other based on politics. That deep state, that is in the best interest, if you will, of the deep state. So what I have written yesterday and I released is an article that I have titled America Remember the Alamo. And I basically set the stage to my effort of linking the financial banking scheme that I feel ran Spain and New Spain, which later became Mexico, and also ran England, and therefore George Washington, the Continental Army. Now, to make that link, I had to dig. Okay, and therefore, Santa Ana troops being funded by the Mexican government, essentially being funded by, again, this same Roman banking machine that ended up funding Washington and his army. And therefore, remembering the Alamo in 2021 as an effort to stand up for your freedoms, folks, that are being infringed upon at an unprecedented level. Mask wearing, vaccine mandates. I mean, this is absurd. A 98% survival rate of a virus. And again, I base this program off of the work that I did, having been exposed to the Zika virus and the pesticide used to combat the Zika virus, known as Naylid, in 2016 in Miami Beach. That's the premise of the work that I've been doing now for 5 years. So I come at the COVID-19 pandemic, if you will, from that angle of having lived and gone through an epidemic locally to South Florida. So remembering the Alamo, remembering the fact that the Texans asked for help from the then American Union, I think it was under Andrew Jackson and James Polk. I'm not sure of the timeline there. I've written James Polk in the article. I may be wrong. But under the aid of the federal government from the United States, those people supported Texas in their efforts to stand for their independence. And they were unsuccessful because Santa Ana took the Alamo now, didn't he? But a month later down in Houston, Sam Houston and friends successfully defended the Battle of Jacinto, defended the Texans. So I've written this in my newly released article that you can find on my website, iantrache.com. Just click on the tab, remember the Alamo, it's just to the right of a 2021 letter that I've written to every U.S. politician, and I've sent it out to over 600. I think I received response from one or two. But with that said, that is a banking, a themed letter, the corruption in the American banking system. And added to that, even though I had not sent that letter to Anthony, Florida Representative Anthony Sabatini clearly stated 3 weeks ago on this show, which usually airs Wednesdays at 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern. But again, I'm starting to do special editions, so if you'd like to catch those and keep track of those schedules, do follow me on Instagram. But he clearly stated on this show that the Federal Reserve Central Bank is unconstitutional and needs to be repealed. This is a sitting state representative for Florida running for a U.S. seat. So we have major problems here. And it's not hard for any American of any type of the level of education or political position, doesn't matter. Any American is able to see that this country is in a $30 trillion debt. Okay, that should be alarming you as you listen to this. And you should be demanding answers from Washington. You should be demanding transparency and demanding answers in regards to that. So what I do in this article, by the way, is I've got a few more minutes before bring on today's guest, Dean Roeder, who has written a fascinating book, I'm assuming, haven't gone through it, but it certainly seems that way, called The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil. Bringing him on here in about five or six minutes. Let me mention this. Last night I gave a two-hour interview with Earth Radio Network, and I went over this article. One of the most alarming things that you will find in that article, which I urge you to read and pass forward, is that Washington and Franklin met Lynch and Harrison, I think it was, the two other people. They met in Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1775. This had been approved. The Flag Committee had been approved. This meeting had been approved. They met with a European man whose identity had been withheld. But according to the authors who I cite in the article, that this European man was someone connected likely to this Roman banking machine, one Lorenzo Ricci. And Lorenzo Ricci happened to have been the 18th, if that is the person. Okay, it's not documented what the person, who the person was in this meeting. And it's really not that important because I get to the crux here for you so you can understand the angle I'm coming at this from. But if indeed it was this Lorenzo Ricci, he was the 18th Superior General of the Society of Jesus. The Society of Jesus are God's army, if you will. They are the military branch of the Vatican. They use other people's armies to achieve their objective. Okay, I'll repeat that. They use other people's armies to achieve their objective. It's kind of like going to a bank, asking for a loan. You take a loan, you build an army, you fight another country. That's kind of the idea here. Again, I'll repeat this: they use other people's armies to achieve their objective. They are an army themselves, but they're not walking around with guns and bombs. They're using other people's militaries, like the U.S. military, for instance, invading Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam. They're using other people's militaries to achieve their objective. It's ingenious, really. It's quite ingenious. So this Ricci supposedly is representing these Europe Roman bankers to finance Washington. Washington needed financing to fight the British. But the ironic thing here is that the flag that was adapted by the United States, you consider the first colonial flag of the United States before it was it Betsy Ross, 1777, flew what became known as the Star Spangled Banner. The predecessor to that flag is this colonial flag, and it bears not stars, but it bears crosses. And it bears the crosses of what are considered the Union Jack. That is the cross of St. Andrew, the cross of St. George, and the cross of St. Patrick, representing Scotland, England, and Ireland. And that appears on the first U.S. colonial flag. But this is the identical flag, as Buckminster Fuller states in this quote that I've listed in the article, that the British East Indies Company was using. It's the identical flag. Therefore, my message, remember the Alamo, follows the banking threads of the corruption, the deep, embedded, dangerous banking corruption from which the United States in 2021 operates off of. The same Roman banking corruption that had fueled Santa Anna to fight and try to reclaim that Texas Republic from Mexico. Inadvertently, through England, was the same banking machine. Whereas there's something called a Hegelian dialectic, and that is by Friedrich Hegel, a German philosopher. And it's stated by former Stanford Hoover. He's a Hoover fellow, Stanford, Anthony Sutton, who I continuously quote because his research is the base upon which I do my work. I've done my work now for 5 years. The Hegelian dialectic, essentially, conceptually, is controlling two opposites. You're creating if you need, you create opposition, and you control the opposition financially. And then you implement your order. Out of whatever type of chaotic atmosphere may ensue, you move in and you implement your order. What I argue today is that the United States military is still far too massive for anyone to take on. You'd have to unionize, or you'd have to put China and Russia together, I would think, in order to combat the size of the U.S. military. It's just simply too massive. So no military on the planet can take it on, but it seems a very valid argument that the COVID-19 is a biological weapon to begin to strip some of those inalienable human rights away. And the target are the American people, because the American people are the last beacon of freedom still standing in the world. And look at Australia. Australia's a mess. Canada, these people are. I love Canadians, and I'm Canadian. My family's Canadian from 1646, but these people are simply too weakened in their approach. They've become too brainwashed in that sense, and they've been unable to organize to fight this monster, this Roman monster. Again, this is my research and from my view. But we're going to get into but the Americans here are putting up a challenge. They're putting up a challenge, and that challenge is growing. And you must continue. You must continue to protest. You must continue your fight wherever you are, wherever on the planet you may be, and certainly in the United States. You must continue to fight this tyrant, because all of the signs that I show, this tyrant runs itself through Rome. Okay, So let's bring on Dean Router. And Dean has written this book, Nazi, the hidden. Excuse me, the hidden Nazi. Don't tell the story of America's deal with the devil. So allow me to dial him in, and we will welcome him to Discussions of Truth. One moment here. Again, you're listening to Ian Trottier. This is Discussions of Truth, and you can find me streaming live at iantrottier.com, discussionsoftruth.com, and I've recently gotten the domain Citizen Examiner because I was wondering what is it that I was doing in citizen journalism. I don't consider myself a journalist. I'm simply a researcher. I've built small, very small little businesses in my history. What am I? I examine things. So Citizen Examiner is another website that I've, domain that I've started. So Dean Router here, ladies and gentlemen, Dean Router. The hidden Nazi, the untold story of America's deal.
Hello, this is Dean.
Dean, Ian Trottier here. Welcome to Discuss Your Truth, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. It's great to be with you.
Well, it is a pleasure of mine as well, Dean. Dean, let's get right to it and discuss the hidden Nazi, the untold story of America's deal with the devil. Take a moment, if you would, please, sir, and introduce yourself to listeners.
Ian, first of all, it's great to be with you. I'm a lawyer by training and trade, and this book was brought to me actually by a colleague of mine from my college years who'd been researching what he described as a notorious and all-powerful Nazi general. In doing his research, he came across another researcher, Colm Lowry, in Ireland. And I was brought in as a lawyer to draft an agreement so the two of them could share their research. And this friend of mine, Keith Chester, who became one of the researchers and co-authors of the book, said, he made startling, what I describe as unbelievable claims about the provenance of this general and the ultimate story that they were in the process of uncovering. I couldn't believe it, Ian, but all I had to do was write an agreement so they could collaborate together and share research. And it's on that basis that I got involved and then became the principal author. I have practiced law and been in federal law enforcement. I've seen the way the world works. I've been involved in a couple book projects before, so it was on that basis, really. That's my background that led me to this project.
So you're a lawyer by trade. What is your experience in law enforcement, Dean?
Well, I've been in the inspector general community of the federal government for about 5 years total, I would say. That is a part of the federal government that polices the expenditure of federal funds with grant recipients and also by federal agencies. So when you think fraud, waste, and abuse, the IGs, the inspectors general, are the guys who are out there, the men and women who are policing the use of funds to make sure that the funds are not being misappropriated, not being stolen outright. And when used, they're used to properly within the guidelines of the grants.
Were you finding any misuse of funds during your time?
Plenty. Yeah. I mean, I was in smaller offices, so our grants were not the mammoth Department of Defense grants where there were so many opportunities for much more fraud. But we saw a lot of misuse of funds, that is, people spending money on things they shouldn't have been spent on. And we also saw some outright theft, which is discouraging. But, that's human nature. And that's why we have law enforcement. That's why we have laws. And, laws are meant to be followed, but they're often broken. And we need the enforcement side of things.
Dean, did you ever at any time envision yourself getting into a book of this type of topic? And I understand this was brought to you to draft an agreement between two researchers, but you've put your name clearly on this book. Did you ever consider getting into this topic?
I did not. I mean, the other book projects I've been involved with are law and policy, and I had always wanted to do something other than that. I am a fan of history. My heritage is German, and I've always been fascinated with World War II. My father was an Army officer, a U.S. Army officer, so he was abroad when I was born, so I happen to have been born in Heidelberg. So I have this great fascination, not just with World War II, but also with the Holocaust and how my ancestors, I mean, my family came here in the late 1800s, so we were on the right side of the war. But still, I had this, you know, notion that my ancestors had helped cause the Holocaust. So I was always interested in it, never thought I'd write a book about it. And I never, ever thought, Ian, that a book of this magnitude, a story this surprisingly revelatory existed. I just thought all the stories of World War II had been told, except for, you know, small little incidents here and there. But this is a dramatic sort of reshaping of some big parts of World War II and the Holocaust, about how it happened, who was responsible for it, who was integral to it, and then who got away scot-free and escaped justice at the end of the war.
So the book is published by Regnery Publishing. It's a division of Salem Media. It's widely distributed. What is the most astonishing thing that you've discovered with this book? Again, the title of the book, The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil. That in itself is quite bold. What's the one thing that stands out at you most, Dean, from writing this book and getting into this this history?
Well, there are so many smaller threads, but it's the main arc of the story. The fact that the hidden Nazi, his name is Hans Kammler, was helpful in the Holocaust. He designed Auschwitz. He designed the gas chambers, the ovens. He was the guy who hired out and built the slave labor camps and the killing camps for Nazi Germany. He was an architect and an engineer. At the end of the war, he's in charge of all of Germany's secret weapons, including, your listeners probably have heard of, the V1 buzz bomb and the V2 supersonic bomb. As the war was ending, everybody knew this was a technology. There'd be this mad scramble for the scientists, and Hans Kammler was in a position to deliver them. Now, a conventional history will tell us that we just got lucky. The Americans got lucky. We stumbled on the rocket scientists, but we prove in the book that Hans Kammler delivered them, and then at the end of the war, faked his own suicide, and that we, the Americans, had him in custody long after the war, long after his reported suicide, which was adjudicated, validated by a German court. So he consequently, nobody searched for him. And we've been in touch with the Mossad, you know, the Israeli intelligence agency, the Wiesenthal Center, the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Special Investigation. Those are our Nazi hunters. Nobody searched for him because everybody bought the suicide. So the most surprising aspect of this book, although there are many, many others, is that overall story arc, the fraud that was perpetrated on the world by Hans Kammler with the help of the Americans.
Can you identify any Americans that were behind this, Dean?
Well, through the work of these researchers I mentioned, the indefatigable work of the researchers, we've just uncovered lots and lots of documents. It seems that Hans Kammler got most of his help from the U.S. Army CIC, that's the Counterintelligence Corps. And the guy who had his name on the paperwork was a lieutenant, a major, and then Lieutenant Colonel Dale Garvey, who worked for Army CIC, the Counterintelligence Corps. They were the group that recruited, that found Kammler, recruited him, and then had him in custody for 11 months after the war. So there are other names involved. Some of them are more speculative. I mean, the biggest name probably is Alan Dulles. There are some strong suggestions that he was involved in this. He certainly had knowledge of it. Whether he was an architect of this plan, and we can't really prove that, but we can certainly show that he was involved in this whole swirl of activity, the idea of the U.S. recruiting Nazis, using them as intelligence assets or exploiting them for their knowledge, and then helping them escape justice. In the case of Kammler, even escaping any historical reckoning until the book, The Hidden Nazi.
Dean, is from your evidence, are you suggesting that active Americans knew of this corrupt, covered-up angle while the war was going on?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. His death was being documented. His suicide had been documented while we had him in custody. So, it's interesting because in the post-war, right after the war, there were two groups of Americans present, really. There were those that were charged with finding Nazi war criminals and then bringing them to justice. And there was another group that was charged with finding any Nazis or Germans. They did not have to be Nazis, but anybody that had valuable information, whether it was how to conduct intelligence against the Soviets or weapons technology or just manufacturing technology, whether it's nylons or synthetic rubber or specialized fuels that the Nazis had developed, even nuclear research. We were after all of it, and everybody knew we were. There are just so many fascinating threads in this book. Now, I do want to say, Ian, I want to be very clear, I don't try to second guess the decisions that were made and the moral calculations that were made in letting this guy escape the docks at Nuremberg. And we just had the 75th anniversary of the culmination of the Nuremberg trials. And Hans Kammler should have been in the docks. He should have been one of the defendants, but he wasn't.
Chapter 10 is titled A Parallel Case. Talk a little bit about that, Dean.
Well, I mentioned Dale Garvey. You asked who was principally responsible for this. I get to that conclusion because there's a guy named Klaus Barbie. He was nicknamed the Butcher of Lyon, France. He ran the Gestapo in Lyon, France, was guilty of torturing, murdering, even skinning people alive in the French Resistance. As the war ended, we, the United States, recruited him as an intelligence asset because he'd been fighting the Soviets. We knew we were going to be in a cold or a hot war with the Soviets. So we recruited Klaus Barbie as an intelligence asset. We used him on the continent in Europe for about 4 years. The whole time the French wanted him, and we denied having him. When it got too hot, when they turned the pressure up, we shipped Klaus Barbie to South America. And he was found there in the 1970s, brought back to France, tried and died in prison. And this was all documented in the 1980s in a Department of Justice report. And it was in that report that we saw the name Dale Garvey arise again and again in the case, the parallel case of Klaus Barbie. And Dale Garvey is the same Dale Garvey, the major, lieutenant colonel later, in Army CIC, is on the documents of Hans Kammler. That's why we think that's a very strong parallel case. And there are a couple others just like it.
What was the location in South America that he was taken?
So, Klaus Barbie to Bolivia. But, you know, there's an interesting, and then people moved around after that. There's something called the rat line that got folks, a lot of times innocent people, but a lot of times hardened Nazis from Germany or Eastern Europe through the Alps into Italy, at which point they were given false papers, new identities, and took steamers down to South America. And they were in Argentina, Bolivia, other South American countries that had been run up to that point by right-wing dictators that were welcoming these folks. And there's a 1953 CIA report, now declassified, that we found that showed the CIA was scared to death about a Fourth Reich and a resurgence Nazi regime because of the presence of so many Germans, tens of thousands in South America, the German villages and towns, German Chamber of Commerce, lots of scientists, lots of treasure, great wherewithal down there. Everybody speaking German. It was like the report, that CIA report, reads like a four-alarm fire or something.
Dean, there's something that my listeners will be attuned to, and this is an operation by the U.S. government to bring this technology stateside. I think as a result of this developing clash with Russia, Operation Paperclip. Does that phrase ring a bell with you, and how is it relevant to your work in this this book?
Sure. There is a book called Operation Paperclip by Annie Jacobson, where she talks about some of the larger patterns of the U.S. bringing Nazis to the United States for self-interested purposes. And as that was done, their records were sanitized. In a lot of cases. I mean, some of the people that came obviously were not guilty of war crimes. They hadn't persecuted Jews. They hadn't used slave laborers, but many had. and many still were valuable to us, and we brought them here, and in doing that, cleansed their records. One that she doesn't talk about very much is Wernher von Braun. He was the chief rocket scientist.
NASA.
We present, and you know, he helped us get on the moon and helped develop our ICBM. We present evidence for the first time in The Hidden Nazi that shows he was much, much deeper into Nazi ideology and the use of slave labor and the cruel treatment of slave laborers than ever previously thought. I mean, he's the guy, you know his name, you've heard of him. He toured the country with Walt Disney, and he became an American hero. He's born, he's buried in Northern Virginia as a hero. And he had a much darker past than we were led to believe. There's a 1948, so this is 3 years after the war ends, an FBI interrogation that's now unclassified that we were able to dig out that shows he not only was hiding documents, rocket documents at the time, but during the war, he had contemplated using a very long-range missile he was developing that could strike the eastern seaboard of the United States. And he was contemplating putting weapons of mass destruction on that long-range missile. Either a nuclear dirty bomb or biological or chemical weapons that they were developed.
Dean, let's draw the ties here between the two gentlemen that are also part of this book, Colm Lowry and Keith Chester. You mentioned one of them being Irish. What does an Irishman have concern in regards to an American involvement in this war?
Well, Colm Lowry he's the Irishman. He was just interested in this Nazi general and developed. I mean, he is a student of history. He knows more about World War II than I'll ever know. He was fascinated because in the 1990s, the name Hans Kammler starts to emerge, and you start to hear different versions of his death. And of course, you know, any two versions of any factual event, one of them can't be true, and possibly all of them are false. But what was clear is that nobody ever found Hans Kammler's body, despite a post-war search. And he had a rank equivalent to George Patton. So it's like losing the body of George Patton. It's just unthinkable. And when Colm heard about this, it just piqued his natural curiosity. He's a problem solver. He's a biologist by trade and a very accomplished guy. He just does this part-time. But he's a World War II buff, I guess you would call him. But now, you know, one of the authors on what I think is a fantastic book.
And were you at all reluctant in getting into this this subject? It certainly would pit America in you know, kind of a negative light, as far as I'm concerned. One that most Americans wouldn't necessarily be too welcoming. Reluctant?
My father's a U.S. Army officer, and I don't want to put America in a bad light. I'm a patriot, but I do think it's important to study history and to get it right and to understand, you know, what we did. I will say, in defense of the folks that made the deal on the ground, I'm very slow to second guess the decision, because I think without Wernher von Braun and the 200 rocket scientists that came to the United States, I'm not sure we would have won the Cold War. It's unknowable. You just can't come to a conclusion like that. But we had, because we had that rocket team, we had a 10-year head start in projecting power across continents. And that became invaluable in, assured mutual destruction and the ability to run the Russians out of money and win the Cold War. So it's very difficult to try and second guess something, you know, 70 years later, decisions that were made on the ground. What is clear is that this was a decision that was made at pretty high levels. It wasn't a lieutenant colonel or a major at Army CIC. This involved a lot more people, a lot higher up.
You mentioned Alan Dulles, and Dulles, of course, the Dulles brothers were certainly. And I'm not sure if it was Alan, which one of them were involved in the official JFK report. There's an airport named after Dulles. Yep. Again, I'm not sure which. Talk a little bit about what you've discovered in regards to his involvement in this story.
Well, Alan Dulles is the one that we were most principally concerned with. He was the head of OSS, the Office of Special Investigations of the United States. That is the precursor to what became the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. So he was the head of OSS in Bern, Switzerland during the war. It was already known that he was a little sort of cavalier. And I don't want to say he was a self-promoter, but he entered into peace negotiations with the Germans with what would be described as incomplete authorization from his higher-ups. So he was a bit of a cowboy trying to end the war, I mean, for good purposes. But what really became clear about Allen Dulles is he and his brother had been law firm partners before the war, very highly ranked, had lots of international clients, and had a very strong interest in the war ending a certain way. That is, in the war ending with a strong Germany, not only that could act as a bulwark against the Soviet Union in the geopolitical sense, but a very strong Germany in a way that would benefit clients. There were, it's not surprising. I mean, the world was beginning to globalize. There's nothing nefarious about having a lot of companies that were doing business in Germany and the United States, even with overlapping boards. But the Dulles brothers were all in the middle of all of that in what I would describe as very intriguing ways. And then his role in OSS and his subsequent role as head of the CIA just position him perfectly to know about and to have sort of put his imprimatur on deals like this. I don't think anything happened by way of recruiting intelligence assets without Allen Dulles knowing about it.
And Dean, have you uncovered a direct link to Dulles' involvement in this particular cover-up with Kaemmler?
So I can't say, no, nothing that would hold up in court. To be very clear, we were able to show some new evidence that had never been presented before about meetings that occurred with Allen Dulles, and these are during the peace meetings with intermediaries and Himmler, who's a well-known name, and Kaemmler on Himmler's train. These are a series of meetings that were somewhat known and have been somewhat reported, but what we were able to show was those meetings started earlier than anybody understood. And if you read the book, The Hidden Nazi, you will see that there's this sort of tightly sequenced series of events that I can describe in 30 seconds. But this V-2 supersonic rocket was first deployed in October of 1944, so about 8 months before the war ends. That's when we see Allen Dulles meeting with Himmler and Kaemmler. A month later, the U.S. signs a big contract with General Electric, and Allen Dulles had General Electric as a client before the war, signs a contract with General Electric to be the U.S. contractor to build a supersonic rocket. A month after that, Kaemmler's emissaries are meeting in Portugal, in Lisbon, on neutral ground with representatives of the U.S. Army and OSS and General Electric. And then in the ensuing months, we see Hans Kaemmler move the rocket team twice. He moved it once from northern Germany, where the Russians were going to inherit the rocket team in their military advance, moved them to central Germany, then found out that under the Yalta Treaty, that land would be occupied by the Russians. So he moved them yet again down to southern Germany, where they were literally within about less than a week's march of the U.S. Army. That's how we got the rocket team in.
Dean, I'm going to insert this at this time. In my research, now I've been doing this program for 5 years. One of the things that caught my interest in 2016 was Standard Oil and their development of a gasoline for the Luftwaffe airplanes, where the Luftwaffe was unable to fly on any other fuel other than what had been designed with this tetraethyl element by the Standard Oil Company. Did you find anything in your research in this book? Did you find anything linking, exposing more corporate, and certainly this being your background for the government, any of this corporate type of greediness involving building up, knowingly building up the German military?
That's a great question. And I think the short answer is yes. That was not a focus of this book. But what I came to learn very clearly is that in the interwar years between World War I and World War II, Germany existed under the Treaty of Versailles, and they were struggling. Their economy was in horrible shape. Their people were very distraught and very disturbed that they had lost World War I unexpectedly. And They were under this debt to pay reparations, and there were unbelievably complicated, intricate, but very extensive links between American businesses and German businesses, and American businesses and the German government, and American financiers and the German government. It was all, and there's nothing per se nefarious about that. I need to be clear about that. That's just the way the world worked back then and now, where you have supranational and global companies. But what you need to know is that they continued to provide goods and services and have business relationships with the Nazis well into the pre-war years, and even as the war was beginning. There's some evidence there. That, as I said, that was not a focus of our book, but it surprised me how closely related all these businesses and governments were and remained in the early years of the war.
It's almost as if there's ties, and certainly there are ties to the previous war.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I think you're right, and it's, we have the benefit of hindsight, and we know that this war ended up with a Holocaust and the murder of millions and millions of people, the diabolical murder of millions and millions of people. And you could say, well, when should you get out under those circumstances? When do you stop doing business with an entity like that? When did it become apparent? We know now that this was a diabolical regime. I don't think anybody really could have predicted it, and it's hard to say that on one day before the war, involvement with them was legitimate and useful and good for your shareholders and good for America because it was trade and that's good for us. And then the next day, it was, you were complicit, you were a collaborator. There are lines that are very difficult to draw.
Yeah, and one thing I've spoken about, just to continue with that, is even the father and grandfather of two former presidents of the United States, Bush, this is Prescott Bush, being involved in a bank called Union Bank, that had funded the Nazi regime, and these are in congressional records as this entity was brought up on, I think it was Trading with the Enemy Act, in the 40s. Talk a bit, Dean. Talk a little bit more about this subject of the book, Hans Kammler. What type of person, and you've mentioned this, I'm skimming through a little bit of the dialogue here in the book. You mentioned some moral grounding. Where do you think this individual was coming from morally?
Good question. We were able to develop a lot of information on him. I actually got to sit down and interview his son, and what I describe in the book is a very chilling incident. I wrote this in first person, which is an interesting way to do it, and an unconventional way to write a nonfiction book, a true story. But we could find that in the 1930s, 1933, Ian, he wrote a treatise on the expansion of Germany to the east and his ambitions, his vision for not just occupying that territory, but getting rid of the population as they went along and repopulating it with German nationals and ethnic Germans. And he envisioned in the process rebuilding things, top to bottom infrastructure in a way that would kill, result in the deaths of 20 to 30 million slaves. And he's writing this, admittedly, after Mein Kampf, and it mirrors in a lot of ways the ambitions of Adolf Hitler's drive for Lebensraum, living room for the German people, living space. But he somehow gets there independently, that this is all necessary and for the German good, and he doesn't seem to care. He just dismisses the idea that it's going to cost the lives of 20 to 30 million people. And then, during the war, he helped make the Holocaust possible. So he was an ideologue. He wasn't just an opportunistic. He wasn't a follower. He was a leader. Having written this treatise, he knew exactly what he was doing. And then he went behind the advancing German army in Russia. He went on a tour to study the various methods of killing while he was putting Auschwitz together. And he came up with this fixed gas chamber. I mean, the Einsatzgruppen in Eastern Europe had been killing people with single rifle shots or pistol shots. They had used some mobile gassing trucks where they put the exhaust into a box truck and packed it with people and killed them that way. And it was through studying those means that Kammler came up with Zyklon B and the gas chambers, and then the crematoria, which he, as an engineer, the gas chambers in the basement, there's an elevator right there that goes up one floor to the crematoria, and these are super crematoria ovens, anything conventional of that era and today, it burns one body at a time, and you get ashes that you can give to a family. Of course, that wasn't a consideration for Kammler or for the Nazis. They wanted to burn as many bodies as possible all at once, and that's the way he got things done. He was not fair to Henry Ford, but he was the standardizer of killing processes and disposal processes, and he did all of that in the name of the Nazi Third Reich. He even, this is so ironic, he had a daughter who, as an infant, was killed in an accident by a nurse who left a bottle of chloroform open. And so the daughter was literally gassed to death. And yet I didn't see anything in him that would amount to a redeeming quality or any moment of pause in his activities.
Dean, you mentioned you have German ancestry and perhaps an emotional attachment to this book. I don't know that you've written. How do you view what as author as the principal author on the cover? How do you view this historical element of Germany? What are your thoughts on this?
It's a bit of a morbid fascination. I view it as a one of the most highly cultured, sophisticated societies in the history of the world, not just from that era, but in the history of the world, that just went screamingly off the rails. And the best I can account for it, I talk about this in the book, is it did it by increments. Where, if you're a student of this era, you know that in the early to mid 1930s, they started to pass different measures here and there that persecuted or limited the Jews' abilities to do things, to get into a school or to own a business or to own property. And everywhere along the way, it seemed like a smaller step, but nobody's talked about this before that I know of, but every one of these steps resulted in secondary gains for other German people. So that if somebody, if a Jewish boy or girl can't get into university, maybe your kid's getting in. So maybe you have that secondary gain. If your friend who's Jewish no longer can run a business, he has to sell his business at 50% off, and you buy it, you get that huge secondary gain. Or the same with his house when he leaves the country, when his family leaves the country. And you can convince yourself maybe you're even doing your friend a favor by buying his house at 50 cents on the dollar because somebody else would buy it at 40 cents on the dollar. So, but in the end, I conclude that the Holocaust was so massive that I think, and the use of slave labor was so ubiquitous that many, many more common German people knew about it than not. And there's this sort of lasting canard that, people just didn't know what was going on. I think it's true that they didn't know the extent of the banality and the extent of the evil, but they knew people were being abused and they knew people were dying.
Yeah, it's not a comfortable feeling in my stomach and in our stomachs. It doesn't sit well with us. And certainly, in the United States, we live in a comfortable environment where all certainly Jews, those of Jewish ancestry or that faith, are welcomed with open arms into the United States. In your view, why is it that this movement set off in Germany? What ignited this type of hatred, if you will, for Judaism in your history, in your research? How do you conclude that?
I think it was a you can sort of draw a straight line in from World War I to World War II. If you know World War I, the Germans were trying to conquer territory. They had never lost a battle on German soil, so much as fought a battle on German soil. They were the victors. They had expanded massively, and they were ready to shut down the war and claim victory. And all of a sudden, the German army surrendered. And people were furious, and there was a lack of understanding. And that was followed by the Treaty of Versailles, which imposed some pretty onerous requirements on Germany that most of the Germans, because their economy started to fall apart, started to blame everyone but themselves. This was something of others making. And And Hitler, in as he's elected and accelerates through the higher reaches of German government, offers a different way. He blames the army, and then he overtly starts to blame Jews and communists, and they become the enemy. And I think there's nothing that unites a people more than something to hate. If this world were invaded by aliens, we would come together. The entire world population would come together to oppose the aliens. But in this case, it was the German people opposing what they were told was the better enemy. And Hitler gave a lot of thought to this, and he basically was able to take advantage of a terrible, terrible moment in German history.
Yeah, Dean Browder, the author here, joining us today, and Dean, well, I don't know if you're more of an attorney or an author, probably more of an attorney, I don't know, but Dean, well, what do you want listeners to take away? What do you want them? What's the main message you would like them to take away as they as they go out and buy the book, read the book, highly recommend it. The Hidden Nazi, the Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil, ladies and gentlemen. America's Deal with the Devil. What is it that you want them to walk away with here regarding Kamler?
I think that, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and I would not have believed if I wasn't involved in the research and the uncovering of documents and the review of that and stitching it all together. I wouldn't have believed this story was possible. I'm still slow to believe that events of today, end up being conspiratorial and things like that. I don't mean to suggest that, but I do think that history has a way of repeating itself, and we make mistakes to the extent we don't study history and pay attention to it. And I am shocked, Ian, by some of the lack of knowledge, lack of information in anybody under the age of 40, really, or 35, maybe. The polls show that most of these people in this country, they don't know about World War II, but they also, in some cases, they don't know what the Holocaust is. They've never heard of Auschwitz. It's startling. The level of ignorance. So, you mentioned people buying this, it makes good gifts. I wouldn't buy it for somebody that's, not yet in high school, probably ninth grade, but anybody, on the younger end, fathers and uncles love this book, but I think if there were a message, I would want younger generation reading this book. And because it does describe World War II, it does describe the Holocaust. It is hard sledding at points because it tells some terrible stories and some things that are difficult to read and difficult to write and learn on my part. But I think it's so necessary to know these things. That would probably be my biggest takeaway, Ian.
Why in your view, Dean, why do you think these Americans continued? Let's say Dulles. Well, why do you think that these people, even you've mentioned Henry Ford, I've mentioned Standard Oil. Why do you think Americans went along with this, knowing that it was essentially an enemy that their country was fighting in that sense? Well, why do you think this happened?
I think it's very similar to the way that it happened with the German people. I think it was incremental, so it's step by step, and no single step seemed remarkably bad. And there were also secondary gains. Meaning, I'm a big believer in capitalism. I'm a free market guy. I'm also a law and order guy. I also think that countries, by and large, act in their own best interest. And I think there was a lot of all of that going on here. But and it happens in, 100 times, and it never leads to a Holocaust. So it's just impossible to know sometimes how evil the people you are dealing with are. And I think that was the case here. I don't think, I can't imagine there's an American businessman who would want to get in bed with a country and a regime that's going to kill tens of millions of people. I don't believe that of American businessmen and women. I think they were sold a bill of goods. I think it's easy to look the other way in a lot of circumstances. There might have been more of that than there should have been. But I think on this side of the Atlantic, I think there was a lot of shock about the exactly the what happened in the Holocaust. That's why Eisenhower took cameras in there, because he thought what had transpired was so horrific. The human mind would have trouble grasping it, and people would reject it out of hand. They would just not believe it because it was so inhumane. That's why Eisenhower took those cameras into those camps as we liberated them. So there would be documentary evidence. So it would be irrefutable.
Dean Ryder, ladies and gentlemen, and the fascinating story that you've uncovered here. I've got two questions. I want you to walk away. I want you to leave listeners with some final words. But before that, Dean, I'd like you to draw any parallels to what we're experiencing in 2020. If you see any parallels, are there anything that we can learn as Americans from this book that you've written and from this story, and anything that we can apply to our current day in 2021?
Yeah, I sort of hinted at this in a previous answer. I think vigilance is always called for. And there's a lot of information swirling around in the world today. There's more information than anybody can absorb. I think people need to be skeptical about what they're hearing and really analyze on their own what they're hearing on either side and beware of your own echo chamber. Having said that, I think it's important to study the Holocaust so something like that does not happen again. But realize that since the 1945, when World War II ended, there have been many, many times where governments have grabbed power and exercised it against their own people. And there hasn't been another Holocaust, nothing of this magnitude. So I don't want to ring alarm bells, but I would call on people to study history and to be vigilant and to really be on the lookout.
Yeah, thank you very much for those words. Dean, what are you up to next? What can listeners expect from you next?
Well, right now I have a proposal in to do another law and policy book on COVID powers. And I am very worried about a government that can declare, either the federal government or on the state level or even local level, that can declare an emergency and in declaring that emergency enhance its own power. I'm very skeptical about government power. Government's obviously necessary. It's the way we organize civil society. We need rules. We need laws. We need enforcement. But when a government can declare itself bigger than it had been the day before because of an emergency, whether it's the war on terror or whether it's the war on drugs or COVID or a year from now, global warming, and who knows what sort of powers will be declared. So that's the next book. And that will be probably an anthology in with a lot of different contributors. So I will just mostly an editor and write an introduction and try and, pull some themes out of that. But that's one major theme I'm looking at.
And Discussions of Truth would be happy to host you when that is ready. Dean, some final words and final thoughts for listeners, please, sir.
Just a compliment to you, Ian. You're a great interviewer. You've asked some questions. I've done hundreds of these, and you've asked some questions I've never gotten before. And you probe well and follow up well, and I compliment you on that.
Well, that's very kind. Very kind of you. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, Dean Ryder, The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil. Dean, I look forward to keeping in touch with you, sir.
Thank you so much, Ian. Great to be with you.
I'm going to end it at that. I'm going to end it at that, and you can. I haven't looked, but I can imagine, folks. This book is widely available. Just pop it into your search engine, and here is an excellent example of learning from our past. What transpired in Germany in the 1940s is absolutely disgusting. It should disgust you. It just speaking with Dean right there, it brought a very tumultuous feeling to my stomach. Put yourself in this position, folks. Put yourself in that position. I mean, you're kind of, I guess I'll continue. I guess I'll speak a little bit here. We're kind of taking on the same type of issue with folks in your family, folks in your business, folks in your inner circle that have been vaccinated versus unvaccinated. If indeed this virus that was born in a, what was it, seafood market in Wuhan, if indeed it's a naturally born virus. Folks, human beings have been walking this planet for how long? Certainly more than 2,000 years. Thousands and thousands and thousands of years, the human being, our predecessors have been walking this planet. Our innate ability, the way that the being is adapted and been designed, or whatever way you want to see it, but the human being as we know it, in my opinion, is fully capable of taking on any type of natural born virus. That's my opinion, and or accommodating to it. So therefore, it's become a political issue, hasn't it? To where if someone close to you has been vaccinated versus unvaccinated. And Dean brings up an incredible point. You let any of that momentum build, whether it's on one side or the other, and the unvaccinated or the vaccinated begins to become a target. This is how these types of events that transpired in Germany happen, where masses of people lose their lives over a political issue. Now, I have my other another angle that I have come from in regards to why this situation, even dating back to World War I, unfolded. What we do know is America is that great bastion, right? America, the United States, is that great banner of freedom for all. Whether you're Jewish, whether you're Islamic, Buddhist, that's what America is built on, in my opinion. I didn't build the country. I don't know the founders. I just know what I was born into in the life that I've lived inside of it, and having visited areas outside of it as well. We are incredibly fortunate. If you are indeed living in America and you're an American, you're a very fortunate person, because you're living inside that organization that by design gives you freedom of religion. But I'll reiterate in my own words what I believe one of the key messages here that Dean was getting across. Don't think for a second that what transpired under Hitler's Germany could not transpire anywhere else, especially in the United States, because something like that can and could transpire elsewhere. It should be your duty to echo Dean, to be vigilant in your local communities, in your state community, in your national community. It's up to you. It's up to you listening to this. It's up to you to be vigilant, to make sure those around you are educated, those around you understand the past, those around you make sure that the atmosphere remain balanced for all. Those are my comments, and again, I urge you to read through this recent article that I've written. I'm calling it America, Remember the Alamo. It goes into really some of these religious-based links that you should be concerned about. And when I started this show, I still don't. I think both sides of the political aisle. There shouldn't be just two sides, but there are. It's typically referred to as a right versus left or conservative versus liberal. There's good in both arguments. There's good in both sides. Living cohesively, peacefully, under the Constitution is the goal, folks. That's what's important, is that a mutual respect is given. Okay. I'll be back in 3 hours, so you can catch me here at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard. Excuse me, 4 hours, with Lucas Hall. And Lucas Hall is suing seven companies over mask mandates. So I'll be hosting him for another special edition on Sunday, later on today. So you can tune into that. And again, follow me on Instagram to keep up with these posts. Dean was very gracious in rejoining the show. I had missed the previous scheduled slot for Dean. So thank you, Dean, for being open to rejoining the program. And he's obviously had some very nice things to say about the show. And this week, coming up on Wednesday, at that Wednesday 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern slot, usually I bring the guest on quarter of. We'll be bringing on Dr. Peter McCullough this week, and also a longtime guest of the show, former defense attorney based in California, Mark Shaw. And Mark Shaw, it continues to dig into Dorothy Kilgallen and his base story called The Reporter That Knew Too Much. And what Dorothy seemingly knew were the connections behind the cover-up of the John F. Kennedy assassination, per what Mark writes about. Okay? That'll be coming up this week, and just lots and lots on the slate. I've got likely Carla Spaulding, a politician, African American out of Florida, joining the program here. I've got to slate her in. Rudy Reyes scheduled to join the program, and we've been talking with Jason Mariner as well, likely joining in January. But lots going on. I'll be in Dallas in a couple weeks for another event, and I thank you for your support, and I thank you for your involvement. And you can buy one of my shirts, Trottier Discusses Your Truth. They're great shirts. I was wearing it in that video at the Alamo. Remember the Alamo, the video I shot with a good friend, politician there in Texas, Jamie. And buy a shirt, donate to the program if you like. Most importantly, folks, spread this word. Send it to a friend. Send it to a family member. I don't care what their political view is. Seriously, I try not to get into politics. I try not to get into religion. When I submitted my name for running District 27 in Florida, I think it was Senate seat, I submitted my name under my own party. Okay, so you know, people would say, "Oh, Ian, you are political." Well, to a degree, yes, but only political for those who are aligned with exposing corruption. Okay, discuss your truth, folks, ladies and gentlemen. Ian Trottier, and until next episode, be awesome.